From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. Major nations agreed on urgent new aid for Syrians and promised to cease hostilities within days. But Russia said it would continue bombing terrorists, casting doubt on whether it would stop an assault on the city of Aleppo that has sent tens of thousands of Syrians fleeing to the border with Turkey and diminished hopes for a negotiated transition from the rule of President Bashar al-Assad. In the United States, the first presidential primary was held in New Hampshire. It complicated Hillary Clinton's path to the Democratic nomination. On the Republican side, Donald Trump came out on top, and the field narrowed as several other hopefuls suspended their campaigns. Abdurrahim, going to start with Syria. There's been a meeting of the so-called International Syria Support Group. They met in Munich on the sidelines of a major defense conference. Secretary of State John Kerry said there was an agreement to have a what he called a cessation of hostilities within days. How realistic is that? How meaningful is it? Is it just the Russians once again promising peace while bombing?
I think, in a way, the fact that it has come so soon after the collapse was perceived as the collapse of the Geneva talks, it's good news. Problem is that we've heard about ceasefires in the past. They've collapsed one after the other for various reasons. And, you know, seen from the point of view of the Russians and Bashar al-Assad, their ally in Syria, because of the recent gains, it could be argued that they've made enough gains to now change their tack. But the flip side of that coin is that since they've made so much gain territorially, then why would they want to stop at this stage and agree to a cessation of hostilities? So I think it's sending mixed signals. I'm not sure the people who are worried about being trapped in a place like Aleppo, I'm not sure how much trust they would put in such a declaration.
Yeah, I think not very much, David. I think the best outcome is perhaps a pause in the fighting so that urgently needed supplies can be delivered to some of these places that have been besieged. I mean, there are 500,000 Syrians who are in places that have not had adequate aid. But in terms of a real end of Russian bombing and its efforts to consolidate territory for Bashar al-Assad, I find that hard to believe.
And you've got these built-in loopholes in the text
where
they say
terrorists,
that they can attack terrorist groups, and we all know that Russia's definition of a terrorist group is more or less anyone who's on the other side, and they bundle them all together. I mean, clearly, you know, this is not the worst news, it's not the worst outcome, but I think that the other thing that you've seen happening here in Washington, D.C., on the political front, is a realization that the last kind of shreds of optimism have been stripped away from the American vision. For more than a year now, for 2 years now, has been that everyone understood that there was not going to be a military victory by one side or the other, that this would not end with a military solution, and that at some point Bashar al-Assad and his allies would have to realize this, as with the rebels, and then there would inevitably be a political process. And that has been the mantra of administration officials for more than 2 years now. I think what you saw this week was the first dawning of a kind of unhappy realization that maybe that's not true, that maybe the Russian intervention, because it is so brutal and so willing to risk civilian casualties, that actually there might be a military victory that allows Assad to keep some sort of rump state.
And maybe
he does not feel, he will not feel obliged to come to the table. And I think that realization coincided with the sense that America really has very little leverage in this process, and Russia has a tremendous amount more leverage than America does.
Yeah. Abdurrahim, this is not a new understanding in Washington. I mean, we've seen certainly that President Obama puts a much higher priority on fighting the Islamic State than he does on fighting Assad. That's been clear all along. The opposition forces in Syria that are not in al-Nusra Front or in ISIS are are limited now in their power. They're very divided. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of these different local organizations and militias. So do you think, I mean, Washington is essentially throwing in the towel and saying, yes, Assad will get to stay in what they're calling useful Syria, the part of Syria that borders on the Mediterranean, on Lebanon, and so on?
Well, I mean, if you track the various pronouncements on Bashar al-Assad by this administration, the Obama administration, over the last 5 years, certainly there's been a lot of change. I mean, remember the days when President Obama was categorical. Bashar al-Assad has lost legitimacy. He's got to go. Arriving at September, last September, when suddenly, yes, he's lost legitimacy, he's got to go, but, you know, we are open to him staying on to oversee some sort of transitional period. And then over the last few days, we've heard Kerry saying that, yes, he's lost legitimacy, but discussing his future, people have to sit at the table. Right. So that's a significant shift. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me one bit if the final station of those shifts is, yes, Bashar al-Assad is part and parcel of the future of Syria and we have to deal with it. But here's the thing. The vision that David has just described, President Obama's vision, that there is no military solution. I think, I'm sure the Russians have shot a big hole now in that vision. There may not be a military solution on the American side, on America and its allies, but clearly for Putin, he seems to think that, you know, there is a military solution and he's imposing it. Having said that, long term, I do not see a military solution. I do not see a military victory for Bashar al-Assad in the sense that he may be able to have, you know, a little Alawistan, as it's being called in the region. How safe and stable will that Alawistan be long term, given that the rest of Syria will continue to be unstable? And with regard to the cessation of the hostilities that they've been talking about now, they've been talking about various people who were using proxies in Syria to fight out this war. So it's not just the international powers who are involved, it's the proxies. And getting all these pieces together,
1,600 militias.
I somehow do not see it.
Yeah, and of course, if one person violates the ceasefire, then
it's out of the window.
Exactly. Another one can. I also wanted to ask you, Abdur-Rahim, about some new figures that came out recently. This is from the Syrian Center for Policy Research. I'm not familiar with this group. They say that the death toll in the last 5 years has been 470,000. And they say that all in all, 11.5% of Syria's population has been killed or injured since the crisis erupted in March 2011. Extraordinary figures. Do you know anything about this group, and do you think these are valid numbers?
I don't, but, you know, these numbers and the argument basically going on around their accuracy remind me of what happened in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Remember, there was never exactly consensus on the casualties in Iraq beginning in 2003. They went from 200,000 to over a million, depending on who you ask for. And at the end of the day, without sounding crass, it almost doesn't matter, you know, what the exact number is. The fact is, almost agrees that the number of casualties is huge in Syria. And, you know, whether you're talking about casualties, people who were killed, people who were injured, people who were displaced, people who were forced into exile, we are talking about a country that has, to all intents and purposes, been destroyed, a country which has ceased to exist as we have known it since the Sykes-Picot Agreement early in the 20th century between the French and the British, whereby Syria and Iraq were created.
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin with Abdur-Rahim Fukara and David Rennie. David, it's not just the numbers of dead, injured. It's also the numbers who are displaced and who have fled. There are something like 60,000 more Syrians who are now trying to get into Turkey. Turkey already has over 2 million refugees. Lebanon has over 1 million. Jordan over 1 million. And, of course, we've seen this extraordinary exodus to Europe as well. I wonder if the Russians aren't playing with this in a way because they want sanctions relief because of Ukraine.
Sure.
Right? And maybe they think that they can force that through sending refugees to Europe. Is that too crass an equation?
At a minimum, I suspect it does not break President Vladimir Putin's heart to see the European Union struggling to maintain solidarity. I mean, he is a man who despises claims of solidarity. He despises claims of altruism. He despises international organizations. So for Europe to be falling apart in a sort of mutual blame game about refugees confirms everything he believes about how the world works, that the world is nasty and brutish and selfish. I think that there's a giant political problem as well emerging between America and its allies in Europe. I thought it was extraordinary this week. We had the French foreign minister, as he retired, saying some very strong things, Laurent Fabius, not just about America's lack of kind of strategy in Syria, but also about America's kind of lack of understanding of how difficult the whole Syrian situation is for Europe. The German ambassador to Washington, who's a clever man, but I've met him, he's very cautious normally, said on the record that America had completely failed to understand how serious a political issue this is for the European Union, how much pain there is. I know from German officials they've been lectured by the White House about, you know, well, it's only 1 million people and you've got a population of 80 million.
And how many are we taking? 60,000?
You know, America is asked to take 20,000 potentially and has a kind of gigantic, meltdown. I think also listeners abroad need to understand something pretty depressing, which is we're talking about this humanitarian catastrophe in Syria. We're talking about the risks to Jordan, to Turkey, to the European Union. American public opinion, as expressed in this presidential campaign that's going on, does not care, is utterly, utterly unmoved. American public opinion wants Syrians to stay in Syria, far away. We just saw an opinion poll in New Hampshire where they just had an early vote on choosing a presidential candidate. Among the Republican voters who voted in that poll, that primary election in New Hampshire, 66%, two-thirds, they agreed with the idea of a ban on all Muslim travel to the United States,
my Lord,
which is the position of Donald Trump, the demagogic candidate who won that primary election.
It's quite extraordinary. Again, though, I'll put the same question to you. I don't know if this is yet another reason why one gets a sense that Assad is there to stay for a long time and that the stabilization, when it comes, will be with him there in control of a very large chunk of Syria, because he'll be able to argue, Abderrahim, to the Europeans that, you know, this people will be able to live within this rump state and they won't all be rushing for the borders.
Well, you know, we'd have to remember that the Americans have two things going for them, which are not going for the Europeans, and that is history and geography. Europe is so close to the lands of Islam, and the Middle East, yes, it is the cradle of Christianity, but over the last 1,400 years, there's been coexistence with Europe, but there's been enmity with Europe. And you think about what happened in Paris a few weeks ago. I mean, the Syrian crisis, whoever committed the terrorist attacks in Paris, suddenly the Syrian crisis exploded right in the heart of Europe at a time when the Europeans are talking about what's happening to Schengen, the Schengen agreement, basically binding a borderless Europe together, what's happening to it under the weight of refugees. The Americans don't have to deal, almost, they don't have to deal with any of these problems directly. And so when it comes to public opinion, as David said here in the United States, is almost entirely disengaged from what's happening in Syria. Not so the Europeans. And it'll be very interesting, at least for me, to see what happens with the Europeans beyond the administration of Barack Obama in terms of how they manage their relations with the next president, depending on what he does or does not do about Syria.
Yeah, we should point out also, David, before we turn to our domestic politics, that I think it's 60,000 Syrians that the U.S. has agreed to take, and there's a very, very stringent vetting process for that. It's not not a question of people just simply overwhelming the border guards. So, I mean, that makes the attitude of some of these candidates even
even harder to understand, but there is a sort of general anxiety level, and clearly Europeans have found that among some of these asylum seekers, there are people who identify with ISIS and other groups.
Absolutely, and Abdurrahim is right. I mean, this country has a long tradition. Look at the 1930s and the debate about not entering the Second World War. One of the most powerful arguments of Americans who didn't want to join the Second World War was, you know, God has set America on the right side of an ocean, far from the blood-soaked kind of atavistic hatreds of Europe, and we would be a fool as Americans to meddle in them. And, you know, divine providence gave us this new continent free of those ancient hatreds. And that was a very powerful argument. It's a great temptation. But, of course, in this modern world of air travel, and of course, as you say, to focus on the threat from refugees from Syria is an odd thing to do, because if you were a terrorist organization wanting to get a terrorist into the United States, you would not send them through the refugee route, because it takes two or three years and they get interviewed by multiple intelligence agencies. You would find one of the many, many radical Islamists who tragically have French passports, British passports, Belgian passports, and can get on a plane today.
Yeah, or you would find a disaffected American, as we saw in San Bernardino.
But so much easier to get a European passport holder who can get on a plane today and fly to America without any visa at all.
Well, let's turn now, Abdurrahim, to the anxieties that are preying on the minds of Americans. We've had our first presidential primary, proper primary, in New Hampshire. It's not a very representative state. It's not very diverse, but, you know, it was pretty stark. Donald Trump, who has said that he would allow no Muslims to come to the United States, topped a crowded field. He got, 35% of the vote. What should we take from this? Is Donald Trump really, does he really have a possibility of becoming a nominee of the Republican Party for president?
You know, to give this a personal flavor, I don't know about other people, but I've always felt that Donald Trump should not be ruled out, the possibility that Donald Trump may go even beyond the Republican nomination is, in the current climate, I would not rule it out. Let me just say this.
Can I have you hold that just for a minute? We need to take time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with David Rennie and Abdurrahim Fukar. Abdurrahim, I interrupted you. You were saying that we could have a President Trump.
I think under the present circumstances, just hearing the anger and the frustration, but also the demagoguery going on in this election, I would not rule it out. You know, before coming to the United States, I lived in Europe for a long time. I covered several elections in Europe. This will be my fifth presidential election in the United States since I've been here. I've always witnessed cynicism. I've always witnessed fear and anger in these elections. That's what a democratic system is all about. I have never seen, though, the lack of the how question that I'm seeing in this particular election. You mentioned Donald Trump and what he says about wanting
to stop
Muslims.
He'll make America great again.
He'll make America great again. He'll want to stop Muslims from coming into the United States. How do you do it? Nobody is asking that question. But he is riding on the strength of people who feel that that should be done because Muslims and Latinos and African Americans and other groups are part of the problem.
David, before we turn to the Democrats, looking at the rest of the Republican field, going forward to South Carolina, which is the next major primary, which of these so-called mainstream Republicans do you think has an opportunity to come out on top? And does Jeb Bush actually have a chance at resurrection here?
So Jeb Bush, no, I don't think he does. Look, if there was a pent-up enthusiasm for another Bush from kind of the pragmatic, pro-business, non-Trump wing of the Republican Party, then they would have shown it in New Hampshire. He spent a fortune on advertising in New Hampshire. It was his kind of state. He came fourth. This was pretty much the worst possible result for the party bosses, for the people who want a sort of sensible, pro-business, pragmatic candidate. Because what they needed was for their bit of the party to find one champion who could then go head-to-head with Donald Trump and also with the other really important figure in this who I think could get the Republican nomination, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who is a real hardline, sort of doctrinaire. I mean, he's not quite as demagogic as Donald Trump, but he's extremely, extremely right-wing. That champion didn't emerge. I mean, what we saw instead was a kind of death pact among the establishment candidates.
Right, Marco Rubio went down.
And someone who had been thought of as a potential champion for that kind of governing wing of the Republican Party was actually damaged badly by another rival, Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, who it was a kind of people called it a murder-suicide pact because he brutally sort of took down Marco Rubio in a TV debate and then himself dropped out of the race because he came sixth.
Right.
So we go into the next stage of this with Donald Trump and Ted Cruz looking pretty strong. And I think what we may have to get ourselves sort of round is maybe there won't be a pragmatic champion. Maybe we assume there must be because we can't imagine a party which doesn't find one. But maybe this time round it's going to be a two-man race between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And to quote Senator Lindsey Graham, a fairly sort of pragmatic Republican in some ways, not on foreign policy, but in some ways, he said that the choice between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz for his party is like being asked to choose between stabbing yourself and being poisoned.
Well, Abdurrahim, the choice on the Democratic side isn't quite so dramatic, although I must say, watching the latest debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, I had to wonder, you know, what the younger people in the audience were thinking. So much of the debate was about Henry Kissinger, and when Bernie Sanders was asked which foreign leaders he admired most, he talked about Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They are both rather old, and they were having a kind of strange debate over some of these issues. How do you think it came out? How did Bernie Sanders come out looking, particularly on foreign policy?
I think it has become conventional wisdom that, you know, there are a lot of young people who are enthusiastic for Bernie Sanders, whether they remember what he remembers, whether they can go as far back in memory as he can. But, you know, all the things that he said about, for example, education, you know, those things.
Free college.
Yeah, free college. Those things have always grabbed that particular demographic. They grabbed that particular demographic when Barack Obama was running in 2008. You know, if I were within the 18 to 26, 27 demographic and I had to choose between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, it's definitely a tough choice, not just because of their age, but also because of Hillary Clinton is a known quantity and she is so attached to Barack Obama in almost everything she defends in terms of domestic and international politics. A lot of these young people are disillusioned with President Barack Obama, so why would they try the same circle again with Hillary Clinton? Bernie, yes, he's promising free education, but in terms of being a known quantity, what exactly he's going to do, especially after the big holes that she shot in his arguments. If I were part of that demographic, I'm not sure I would put a lot of faith in what he says.
Yeah. Do you think, David, that he was damaged by her assault? She certainly tried to pin him down on specifics for many of his promises.
So I think we saw, no, not last night, but I think we saw the start of some areas where he's vulnerable. On foreign policy, if you actually look at what he was saying, when he talked about mistakes that Henry Kissinger, in his view, had made in Southeast Asia, he talked even about the CIA's role in toppling an Iranian prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in the 1950s. What he was really saying is that he comes from that part of the American left that think that America is rather wicked in its foreign policy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's his record. You know, he was, when he was a young politician, he was mayor of a city in his home state of Vermont. He was very keen on sending letters to the left-wing regime in Nicaragua, apologizing on behalf of the American people for Ronald Reagan's policies in Nicaragua. He took his honeymoon in the Soviet Union. I mean, he is a serious old lefty. I mean, poor wife, really? I mean, so I think, you know, that didn't hurt him last night, but that's not where most Americans are. Most Americans don't actually think their own country is essentially a wicked actor abroad. So I think that's an area we'll see coming up again if he keeps doing well.
Yeah, well, I did want to say one thing about Hillary Clinton. I thought she did better, but she has still this kind of imperious quality to her. And she kind of reminded me of a Maggie Thatcher in a way, which is perhaps not the most useful thing if you're looking for the youth vote. Although the Brits loved Maggie, so who knows?
Some did.
Yeah, anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fouad. Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Thanks for listening.